meal," said Cohen, "was heroic. Now have a word for it."
"That's right, Mrs. McGarry," said Evil Harry. "Even rat doesn't taste this much like chicken." "Yes, the tentacles hardly spoiled it at all," said Caleb enthusiastically.
They sat and watched the view. What had once been the world below was now a world in front, rising like an endless wall.
"What are they, right up there?" said Cohen, pointing.
"Thanks, friend," said Evil Harry, looking away. "I'd like the chicken to stay down, if it's all the same to you."
"They're the Virgin Islands," said the minstrel. "So called because there's so many of them."
"Or maybe because they're hard to find," said Truckle the Uncivil, burping.
"You can see the stars from up here," said Mad Hamish, "even though 'tis day."
Cohen grinned at him. It wasn't often Mad Hamish volunteered anything.
"They say every one of 'em's a world," said Evil Harry.
"Yeah," said Cohen. "How many, Bard?"
"I don't know. Thousands. Millions," said the minstrel.
"Millions of worlds, and we get what? How old are you, Hamish?"
"What? How about the day the old Thane died?" said Hamish.
"When was that? Which old Thane?" said Cohen patiently.
"What? I ain't a scholar. I cannot remember that kind of stuff."
100 years, maybe," said Cohen. 100 years. And there's millions of worlds."
He took a pull of his cigarette and rubbed his forehead with the back of his thumb. "It's a bugger." He nodded at the minstrel.
"What did your mate Carolinas do after he'd blown his nose?"
"Look, you really shouldn't think of him like that," said the minstrel hotly. "He built a huge empire, too big, really. And in many ways he was a lot like you. Haven't you heard of the Sortian Knot?"
"Sounds dirty," said Truckle. "Oh, sorry."
The minstrel sighed.
"It was a huge, complicated knot that tied two beams together in the Temple of Ophla in Sort, and it was said that whoever untied it would reign over the whole of the continent," he said.
"They can be very tricky knots," said Mrs. McGarry.
"Carolinus sliced right through it with his sword," said the minstrel.
The revelation of this dramatic gesture did not get the applause he expected.
"So he was a cheat as well as a crybaby," said Boy Willie.
"No, it was a dramatic, nay, portentous gesture," snapped the minstrel.
"Yeah, okay, but it's not exactly untying, is it? I mean, if the rules said untying, I don't see why he should..."
No, the lad's got a point," said Cohen,
who seemed to have been turning this one over in his mind.
"It wasn't cheating, because it was a good story. Yeah, I can understand that," he chuckled. "I can just imagine it, too. A load of whey-faced priests and such like, standing around and thinking, that's cheating. But he's got a really big sword, so I won't be the first to point this out. Plus, this damn great army is just outside."
"Ha! Yeah.
What do you do next?"
"Conquered most of the known world."
"Good lad. And after that?"
"He went home, reigned for a few years. Then he died and his sons squabbled and there were a few wars and... that was the end of the empire."
"Children can be a problem," said Vina,
without looking up from carefully embroidering forget-me-nots around Burn This House.
"Some people say you achieve immortality through your children," said the minstrel.
"Yeah?" said Cohen. "Name one of your great-grandads, then."
"Well, see?
"Now, I got lots of kids," said Cohen. "Haven't seen most of them. You know how it is. But they had fine, strong mothers, and I hope like hell they're all living for themselves, not for me. Fat lot of good they did your Carolinus, losing his empire for him."
"But there's a lot more a proper historian could tell you," said the minstrel.
"Ta," said Cohen. "It's what ordinary people remember that matters. It's songs and sayings. Doesn't matter how you live and die, it's how the bards wrote it down."
The minstrel felt their joint gaze fix on him.
I'm making lots of notes," he said.
"Ook," said the librarian by way of explanation. "And then he says something fell on his head," Rincewind translated. "It must have been when we dived."
"Can we throw some of this stuff out of the ship to lighten it?" said Carrot. "We don't need most of it."
Alas, no," said Leonard. "We will lose all our air if we open the door."
"But we've got these breathing helmets," Rincewind pointed out.
"Three helmets," said Leonard.
The omniscope crackled. They ignored it. The kite was still passing under the elephants, and the thing showed mostly a kind of magical snow. But Rincewind did glance up, and saw that someone in the storm was holding a card on which had been scrawled, in large letters, "Stand by." Ponder shook his head.
"Thank you, Arch-Chancellor, but I'm far too busy for you to help me," he said.
"But will it work?"
"It has to, sir. It's a million-to-one chance."
"Oh, then we don't have to worry. Everyone knows million-to-one chances always work."
"Yes, sir. So all I have to do is work out if there's still enough air outside the ship for Leonard to steer it, or how many dragons he will need to fire for how long, and if there will be enough power left to get them off again. I think he's travelling at nearly the right speed, but I'm not sure how much flame the dragons will have left, and I don't know what kind of surface he'll land on or anything that they'll find there. I can adapt a few spells, but they were never devised for this sort of thing."
"Good man," said Ridcully.
"Is there anything we can do to help?"
said the Dean. Ponder gave the other wizards a desperate look. How would Lord Veterinari have handled this?
"Why, yes," he said brightly. "Perhaps you would be kind enough to find a cabin somewhere and come up with a list of all the various ways I could solve this, and I will just sit here and toy with a few ideas."
"That's what I like to see," said the Dean. "A lad with enough sense to make use of the wisdom of his elders."
Lord Veterinari gave Ponder a faint smile as they left the cabin. In the sudden silence, Ponder pondered. He stared at the orrery, walked around it, enlarged sections of it, peered at them, pored over the notes he had made about the power of dragon flight, stared at a model of the kite, and spent a lot of time looking at the ceiling. This wasn't the normal way of working for a wizard. A wizard evolved the wish and then devised the command. He didn't bother much with observing the universe. Rocks and trees and clouds could not have anything very intelligent to impart. They didn't even have writing on them, after all. Ponder looked at the numbers he had scribbled. As a calculation, it was like balancing a feather on a soap bubble which wasn't there. So he guessed. Extract from the notebooks of Leonard of Quirm on Clothing for Travelling the Empty Void. Costume Mark 1 is for the wizard Rincewind. Comprises a converted pearl diving helmet fitted with a simple pressure gauge. Note, if eye holes turn red, head has exploded. Light boots for moving fast in the event of unexpectedness, and an oiled leather suit over canvas undersuit over three layers of wool for warmth in the endless gulfs. Capacious thigh pouches will aid in collecting specimens of rock, which could also be used to combat excessive levity. One crew member has made a special request for a pocket containing cards with messages such as Run, I Surrender, Sturcus, Help, and so on, for use in the soundless spaces. There can be no voice where there is no motion or percussion of the air. Adorno Maximus Magister. Costume Mark 2 for Captain Carrot Warrior will comprise a lightweight suit of stretched leather and canvas, light leather gloves with an outer covering of mail, with heavy leathered bands to prevent chest exploding, and an adapted helmet in the traditional style of the Ankh-Morpork Watch. Costume Mark 3 for Leonard of Quirm will include a blown glass helmet for all-round observation, fitted with improved air renewer, pockets to hold pencils, crayons, notebooks, etc., and an emergency air supply contained in puffed sleeves. A holster will be used to hold brushes and weighted boots to hold the wearer down, in conditions of levity, for instance. Experimental recycling pants will complete the costume. A memo to self, these, alas, are not quite perfect yet. On the kite, the situation was being workshopped. This is the means by which people who don't know anything get together to pool their ignorance.
"Could we all hold our breath for a quarter of the time?" said Carrot.
No, breath doesn't work like that, alas," said Leonard.
"Perhaps we should all stop talking," said Rincewind.
"Ook,"
said the librarian, pointing to the fuzzy screen of the omniscope. Someone was holding up another placard. The huge words could just be made out. "This is what you do." Leonard snatched a pencil and began to scribble in the corner of a drawing of a machine for undermining city walls. 5 minutes later, he put it down again.
"Remarkable," he said. "He wants us to point the kite in a different direction and go faster."
"Where to?"
"He doesn't say, but, ah, yes, he wants us to fly directly towards the sun."
Leonard gave them one of his bright smiles. It faced three blank stares.
"It will mean allowing one or two individual dragons to flare for a few seconds to bring us around, and then the sun," said Rincewind.
"It's hot," said Carrot.
"Yes, and I am sure we're all very glad of that," said Leonard, unrolling a plan of the kite.
"Ook, I'm sorry?"
"He said, and this boat is made of wood," said Rincewind. "All that in one syllable?" "He's a very concise thinker. Look, Stibbons must have made a mistake. I wouldn't trust a wizard to give me directions to the other side of a very small room."
"He does seem to be a bright young man, though," said Carrot.
"You'll be bright, too, if you're in this thing when it hits the sun," said Rincewind.
"Incandescent, I expect."
"We can point the kite if we're very careful how we operate the port and starboard mirrors," said Leonard thoughtfully. "There may be a little trial and error."
"Ah, we seem to have the hang of it," said Leonard.
He turned over a small egg timer.
"And now, all dragons for 2 minutes."
"I suppose he'll tell us what happens next,"
shouted Carrot, while behind them things tinkled and creaked.
"Mr. Stibbons has 2,000 years of university expertise behind him," yelled Leonard above the din.
"How much of that has involved steering flying ships with dragons?"
screamed Rincewind. Leonard leaned against the tug of homemade gravity and looked at the egg timer.
"About 100 seconds.
"Ah, it's practically a tradition then."
Erratically, the dragons stopped flaming. Once again, things filled the air. And there was the sun, but no longer circular. Something had clipped its edge.
"Ah," said Leonard, "how clever. Gentlemen, behold the moon."
"We're going to hit the moon instead," said Carrot. "Is that better?"
"My feelings exactly," said Rincewind.
"Ook! I don't think we're going so very fast," said Leonard.
"We're only just catching it up. I think Mr. Stibbons intends that we land on it."
He flexed his fingers.
"There's some air there, I'm sure of it," he went on, "which means there is probably something we can feed to the dragons. And then, and this is very clever thinking, we ride on the moon until it rises over the disk, and all we need to do is drop down lightly."
He kicked the release on the wing levers. The cabin rattled to the spinning of the flywheels. On either side, the kite spread its wings.
"Any questions?" he said.
"I'm trying to think of all the things that could go wrong," said Carrot.
"I've got 9 so far," said Rincewind, "and I haven't even started on the fine detail."
The moon was getting bigger, a dark sphere eclipsing the light of the distant sun.
"As I understand it," said Leonard, as it began to loom in the windows, "the moon, being much smaller and lighter than the disk, can only hold on to light things like air. Heavier things, like the kite, should hardly be able to stay on the ground."
"And that means," said Carrot,
"we should just float down," said Leonard. "But holding on to something might be a good idea."
They landed. It's a short sentence, but contains a lot of incident. There was silence on the boat, apart from the sound of the sea and Ponder Stibbons's urgent muttering as he tried to adjust the omniscope.
"The screams!" murmured Mustrom Ridcully after a while.
"But then they screamed a second time, a few seconds later," said Lord Vetinari.
"And a few seconds after that," said the Dean.
"I thought the omniscope could see anywhere," said the patrician, watching the sweat pour off Ponder. "At the shards, don't seem stable when they're too far apart, sir," said Ponder. "And there's still a couple of thousand miles of world and elephant between them,
The omniscope flickered and then went blank again.
"A good wizard, Rincewind," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. "Not particularly bright, but frankly, I have never been quite happy with intelligence. An overrated talent, in my humble opinion."
Ponder's ears went red.
"Perhaps we should put a small plaque up somewhere in the university," said Ridcully. "Nothing garish, of course."
"Gentlemen, are you forgetting," said Lord Vetinari, "soon there will be no university."
"Ah, Well, a small saving there, then. Hello? Hello, is there anyone there?
And there was, fuzzy but recognisable, a face peering out of the omniscope.
Captain Carrot! Ridcully roared. How did you get that damn thing to work?
I just stopped sitting on it, sir.
Are you all right? We heard screams, said Ponder.
That was when we hit the ground, sir.
But then we heard screams again.
That was probably when we hit the ground for the second time, sir.
And the third time?
Ground again, sir. You could say the landing was a bit tentative for a while there.
Lord Veterinary leaned forward.
Where are you?
Here, sir. On the moon. Mr. Stebbins was right. There is air here. It's a bit thin, but it's fine if your plans for the day include breathing.
Mr. Stebbins was right, was he? Said Ridcully, staring at Ponder. How did you work that out so exactly, Mr. Stebbins?
I...
Ponder felt the eyes of the wizards on him.
He stopped. It was a lucky guess, sir.
The wizards relaxed. They were extremely uneasy with cleverness, but lucky guessing was what being a wizard was all about.
Well done, that man, said Ridcully, nodding. Wipe your forehead, Mr. Stebbins. You've got away with it again. I've taken the liberty of asking Rincewind to take a picture of me planting the flag of Ankh-Morpork and claiming the moon on behalf of all nations of the Disc, Your Lordship, Carrot went on.
Very patriotic, said Lord Veterinary. I may even tell them.
However, I can't show you this on the omniscope because, shortly afterwards, something ate the flag. Things here aren't entirely what you'd expect, sir.
They were definitely dragons, Rincewind could see that, but they resembled swamp dragons in the same way that greyhounds resemble those yappy little dogs with lots of Z's and X's in their name. They were all nose and sleek body, with longer arms and legs than the swamp variety, and they were so silvery that they looked like moonlight hammered into shape. And they flamed, but it was not from the end that Rincewind had hitherto associated with dragons. The strange thing was, as Leonard said, that once you stopped sniggering about the whole idea, it made a lot of sense. It was so stupid for a flying creature to have a weapon which stopped it dead in mid-air, for example. Extract from the notebooks of Leonard O'Quirm. Some observation upon moon dragons. These creatures are distinguished by their small, ornamental wings, sleek body shape, and regal, alert posture. The beard and thrips are luxuriant and swept back from the chin and head. The scales enlarged and prominent, possibly for steering. In young moon dragons, one notes the elevation of the queasals and early growth of the thrips. Some specimens were noticeably hammering when observed. The eggs of this dragon are curiously formed, having a distinctive pear-like shape. I speculate that this may help it to survive a long drop to the ground. Dragons of all sizes surrounded the kite, watching it with deer-like curiosity. Occasionally, one or two would leap into the air and roar away, but others would land to join the throng. They stared at the crew of the kite as if they were expecting them to do tricks or make an important announcement. There was greenery, too, except that it was silvery. Lunar vegetation covered most of the surface. The kite's third bounce and long slide had left a trail through it. The leaves were...
Hold still, will you?
Rincewind's attention was drawn to his patient as the librarian struggled. The problem with bandaging an orangutan's head is knowing when to stop.
It's your own fault, he said. I told you. Small steps, I said, not giant leaps.
Carrot and Leonard bounced around the side of the kite.
Hardly any damage at all, said the inventor as he drifted down. The whole thing took the shock remarkably well, and we're pointing slightly upwards. In this... In general lightness, that should be quite sufficient to allow us to take off again, although there is one minor problem. A shoe, will you?
He waved away a small silver dragon that was sniffing at the kite, and it took off vertically on a needle of blue flame.
We're out of food for our dragons, said Rincewind. I've looked. The fuel bunker broke open when we landed for the first time.
But we can feed them some of the silver plants, can't we? Said Carrot. The ones here seem to do very well on them.
Aren't they magnificent creatures? Said Leonard, as a squadron of the creatures sailed overhead.
They turned to watch the flight, then stared beyond it. There was possibly no limit to how often the view could amaze you. The moon was rising over the world, and Elephant's Head filled half the sky. It was simply big. Too big to describe. Wordlessly, all four voyagers climbed a small mound to get a clear view, and they stood in silence for some time. Dark eyes the size of oceans stared at them. Great crescents of ivory obscured the stars. There was no sound but the occasional click and swish as the iconograph imp painted picture after picture. Space wasn't big. It wasn't there. It was just nothing, and therefore, in Rincewind's view, nothing to get humble about. But the world was big, and the elephant was huge.
"Which one is it?" said Leonard after a while.
"I don't know," said Carrot. "You know, I'm not sure I ever really believed it before. You know, about the turtle and the elephants and everything. Seeing it all like this makes me feel very, very..."
"Scared?" suggested Rincewind.
"No. Upset? No. Easily intimidated? No."
Beyond the rimfall, the continents of the world were coming into view under swirls of white cloud.
"You know, from up here, you can't see the boundaries between nations," said Carrot, almost wistfully.
"Is that a problem?" said Leonard.
"Possibly something could be done.
Maybe huge, really huge buildings in lines along the frontiers," said Rincewind. Or very wide roads. You could paint them different colours to save confusion."
"Should aerial travel become widespread," said Leonard, "it would be a useful idea to grow forests in the shape of the name of the country, or of other areas of note. I will bear this in mind."
"I wasn't actually suggest—" Carrot began,
and then he stopped and just sighed. They went on watching, unable to tear themselves away from the view. Tiny sparkles in the sky showed where more flocks of dragons were sweeping between the world and the moon.
"We never get to see them back home," said Rincewind.
"I suspect the swamp dragons are their descendants, poor little things," said Leonard, "adapted for heavy air."
"I wonder what else lives down here that we don't know about," said Carrot.
"Well, there's always the invisible squid-like creature that sucks all the air out of—"
Rincewind began, but sarcasm did not carry very well out here. The universe diluted it. The huge, black, solemn eyes in the sky withered it. Besides, there was just too much. Too much of everything. He wasn't used to seeing this much universe all in one go. The blue disk of the world, unrolling slowly as the moon rose, looked outnumbered.
"It's too big," said Rincewind.
"Yes. Ook."
There was nothing to do but wait for full moonrise, or disk sink. Carrot carefully lifted a small dragon out of a coffee cup.
"The little ones get everywhere," he said. "Just like kittens, but the adults keep their distance and stare at us."
"Like cats, then," said Rincewind.
He lifted up his hat and untangled a small silvery dragon from his hair.
"I wonder if we ought to take a few back. We'll be taking them all back if we're not careful."
"They look a bit like Errol," said Carrot.
"You know, the little dragon that was our watch mascot. He saved the city by working out how to, flame backwards. We all thought he was some new kind of dragon," Carrot added. "But now it looks as though he was a throwback. Is Leonard still out there?"
They looked out at Leonard, who had taken half an hour off to do some painting. A small dragon had perched on his shoulder.
"He says he's never seen light like it," said Rincewind. "He says he must have a picture. He's doing very well, considering."
"Considering what?"
"Considering that two of the tubes he was using contained tomato puree and cream cheese."
"Did you tell him?"
"I didn't like to. He was so enthusiastic."
"We'd better start feeding the dragons," said Carrot, putting his cup down.
"All right. Can you unstick this frying pan from my head, please?"
Half an hour later, the flicker of the omniscope screen illuminated Ponder's cabin.
"We've fed the dragons," said Carrot. "The plants here are odd. They seem to be made of a sort of glassy metal. Leonard has a rather impressive theory that they absorb sunlight during the day and then shine at night, thus creating moonlight. The dragons seem to find it very tasty. Anyway, we shall be leaving shortly. I am just collecting some rocks."
"I'm sure they will come in useful," said Lord Vetinari.
"Actually, sir, they will be very valuable," whispered Ponder Stibbons.
"Really?" said the patrician.
"Oh, yes. They may well be completely different from rocks on the disk."
"And if they are exactly the same?"
"Oh, that would be even more interesting, sir."
Lord Vetinari looked at Ponder without speaking. He could deal with most types of mind, but the one apparently operating Ponder Stibbons was of a sort he had yet to find the handles on. It was best to nod and smile and give it the bits of machinery it seemed to think were so important, lest it run amok. "Well done," he said. "Ah, yes, of course. And the rocks may contain valuable ores, or possibly even diamonds?" Ponder shrugged.
"I wouldn't know about that, sir, but they may tell us more about the history of the moon."
Vetinari's brow wrinkled.
"History," he said, "but no one lives... yes, well done. Tell me, do you have all the machinery you need?"
The swamp dragons chewed the moon leaves. They were metallic, with a glassy surface, and little blue and green sparks sizzled over the dragon's teeth when they bit into them. The voyagers piled them up high in front of the cages. Unfortunately, the only explorer who would have noticed that the moon dragons ate only the occasional leaf was Leonard, and he had been too busy painting. Swamp dragons, on the other hand, were used to eating a lot of things in the energy-poor environment of their world. Stomachs used to transmuting the equivalent of stale cakes into usable flame took delivery of dielectric surfaces chock-full of almost pure energy. It was the food of the gods. It was only going to be a matter of time before one of them burped. The whole of the disc was... well, there was the problem from Midswin's point of view. It was below them now. It looked below, even if it was really just over there. He couldn't get over the dreadful feeling that once the kite was airborne, it would simply drop down to those distant fleecy clouds. The librarian helped him winch in the wing on his side as Leonard made ready to depart.
"Well, I know we've got wings and everything," Rincewind said. "It's just that I'm not at home in an environment where every direction is down. Ook! I don't know what I'll say to him. Don't blow the world up sounds a pretty persuasive argument to me. I'd listen to it. And I don't like the idea of going anywhere near the gods. We're like toys to them, you know. And they don't realise how easily the arms and legs come off," he added to himself.
"Ook! Pardon? Do you really say that? Ook! There is a monkey god? Ook!
No, that's fine. Not one of our local ones, is he?
Eek!
Oh, the counterweight continent. Well, they'll believe just about anything over..." He glanced out of the window and shuddered. "Down there."
There was a thud as the ratchet clicked into place.
"Thank you, gentlemen," said Leonard. "Now, if you'll just take your seats, we..."
The thump of an explosion rocked the kite and knocked Rincewind off his feet.
"How curious. One of the dragons appears to have fired a little early."
"Behold," said Cohen, striking a pose.
The Silver Horde looked around.
"What?" said Evil Harry.
"Behold, the citadels of the gods," said Cohen, striking the pose again.
"Yeah, well, we can see it," said Caleb. "Is there something wrong with your back?"
"Write down that I spake behold," said Cohen to the minstrel. "You don't have to write down any of this other stuff."
"You wouldn't mind saying spaking? Sorry, speaking, behold the temples of the gods, would you?" said the minstrel. "It's got a better rhythm."
"Ha! This takes me back," said Truckle. "Remember, Hamish, you and me signed on with Duke Leofric the Legitimate when he invaded Nothingfjord?"
"I mind it."
"5 damn days that battle took," said Truckle. "'Cause the Duchess was doing a tapestry to commemorate it, right? We had to keep doing the fights over and over again. And then there was the devil to pay when she was changing needles. There's no place for the major on the field of battle, I've always said."
"Aye, and I mind you making a rude sign to the ladies," Hamish cackled. "I saw that old tapestry in the castle of Rosante years later, and I could tell it was you."
"Could we just get on with it?" said Vina.
"You see, there's the problem," said Cohen. "It's no good just doing it. You've got to remember your posterity."
said Truckle.
"Laugh away," said Cohen. "But what about all those heroes that aren't remembered in songs and sagas, eh? You tell me about them."
"Eh? What heroes that aren't remembered in songs and sagas?"
"Exactly."
"What's the plan?" said Evil Harry, who had been watching the shimmering light over the city of the gods.
"Plan?" said Cohen. "A fortune you. We're going to sneak in, smash the igniter, and run like hell."
"Yeah, but how do you plan to do this?" said Evil Harry.
He sighed when he saw their faces.
"You haven't got one, have you?" he said wearily. "You were just going to rush in, weren't you? Heroes never have a plan. It's always left up to us Dark Lords to have the plans.
"This is the home of the gods, lads. You think they won't notice a bunch of humans wandering around?"
"We are intending to have a magnificent death," said Cohen.
"Right, right. Afterwards? Oh, dearie me. Look, I'd be thrown out of the secret society of evil madmen if I let you go at it mob-handed." Evil Harry shook his head. "There's hundreds of gods, right? Everyone knows that. And new gods turning up all the time, right? Well, doesn't a plan suggest itself? Anyone?" Truckle raised a hand.
"We rush in," he said.
"Yeah, we're all real heroes here, aren't we?" said Evil Harry. "No, that wasn't exactly what I had in mind. Lads, it's lucky for you that you've got me."